You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. Thank you all for being here today. My name is Kevin Casasamora. I'm a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program, as well as the acting director of the Latin American Initiative here at Brookings. On October the 30th, Colombians will go to the polls to select governors, mayors, and local councils. The elections will be a very serious test for the administration of President Juan Manuel Santos, including as to how the Santos government will cope with the growing power of new illegal armed groups and its paramilitary successors. Despite many successes achieved in the course of a largely successful first year since President Santos took over in August of 2010, including robust economic growth to the tune of 5% a year, and most recently, the long-delayed ratification of the free trade agreement with the U.S. by Washington. And I should count amongst the successes, by the way, the fact that our good friend and former colleague Mauricio Cárdenas joined the Santos administration recently as Minister of Energy and Mining, which is obviously wonderful news for him as for Colombia. Despite all this, Colombia's secular challenges concerning violence, insurgency, and the rule of law remain pressing and complex. They manifest themselves in the election. Just to give you an idea, according to Colombia's own interior ministry, more than 10% of the candidates have criminal records. Moreover, unlike national elections, Colombia's local elections are often under threat by corruption, voter intimidation, and political violence. To President Santos's credit, his administration has deployed early electoral safeguards and recognized the threat paramilitary groups pose. In July of 2011, the Santos government signed into law a far-ranging political reform, paving the way for the imposition of penalties on parties that endorse candidates with links to illegal armed groups or face investigation for drug trafficking and crimes against humanity. Election financing rules and anti-corruption norms have also been toughened up. This is merely one example of the current administration's intent in improving the country's adherence to the rule of law. On August the 7th, Santos presented his Comprehensive Security Policy for Prosperity plan. The plan is aimed at reducing homicides, kidnappings, extortions, and other crimes by 50% by 2025. Under the new plan, the military forces and the national police would apply their efforts and differentiation, taking into account the specific characteristics of each zone, and they classify the zones into red zones, in which the objective is to end violence, in yellow zones, in which the objective is to create proper conditions for democratic governance, and in green zones, where the goal is to put optimum security conditions in place to promote prosperity. To talk about all this, to talk about the forthcoming elections in Colombia, the efforts and performance of the Santos administration in consolidating and extending the security gains accrued during the past decade, to talk about the differences between the approaches to security of the current and the previous administration of President Álvaro Uribe, to talk about the prospects of the end of the FARC's insurgency, which, to my recollection, is probably the longest insurgency in the world at this point, and finally, to talk about the ways in which the U.S. can help or hinder this process, we have assembled a very distinguished group of speakers here, supremely knowledgeable on all things Colombian, particularly on issues related to violence and the rule of law. They are, and I start from the extreme left, from your perspective. First, we have our very own Wanda Felbert Brown, who is a fellow in the Latin American Initiative and in the 21st Century Defense Initiative in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. She's surely one of the world's foremost experts on illicit economies and international and internal conflicts under management, including counterinsurgency. Then we have my very good friend, we go back a long time, Adam Isaacson, who joined the Washington Office for Latin America in 2010, after many, many years working on Latin American and Caribbean security issues with the Center for International Policy here in Washington. Closer to me, we have Claudia Lopez, a Colombian political researcher and terrific investigative journalist, who is currently pursuing doctoral studies in political science at Northwestern University in Chicago. And finally, last but not least, we have Virginia Bouvier, who is a senior program officer for the Center of Innovation at the U.S. Institute of Peace, where she heads the Colombia Conflict Team. With this group of speakers, I'm pretty sure that this will prove a fascinating discussion about a very important country in Latin America, a country with huge untapped potential, and that seems to be undergoing a mix of positive and negative changes. This is a discussion that we expect you to join once the panelists give us their remarks. Thank you very much. Over to you, Wanda.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Kevin said that Brookings is lucky and Mauricio Cardenas is fortunate and rewarded for his services to get the ministry portfolio. Well, we are equally lucky that Kevin was able to step into the void and take over managing the program. So thank you, Kevin. And good morning to all of you. Colombia is a fascinating case. Fascinating because if you listen to narratives about Colombia in the United States, including at this week's hearing on the Andes, you could easily get the impression that Colombia is a miracle story where everything is going extremely well. And without doubt, some very significant improvements have taken place in Colombia. As always, the angel and the devils are in the details, and how one plays the baseline game, one can reach some either very optimistic or far less optimistic conclusions about Colombia. So if you look at what's happening in Colombia compared to what was happening any time in the 1990s and the early to mid-2000s, things are significantly better. At the time, it was a very intense civil war with a very successful insurgency. Some analysts even worried that possibly the national government could fall. Travel along major roads was not possible. The insurgents were also, in some cases, present in the cities. At the same time, you had paramilitary groups, extremely strong at the time, conducted a great deal of massacres, and both of these actors were involved in the drug trade and getting a lot of various form of strength from participating in the drug trade. General homicide levels, kidnappings, were extraordinarily high. For a variety of reasons, including U.S. assistance under Plan Colombia, the Colombian forces have been able to turn the situation around. And by 2008, Colombia was a far safer place. The FARC was pushed out from all the strategic corridors, all the major population areas. Travel east, the Colombian government reached a deal with the paramilitaries to demobilize them, that reduced violence in many areas to a great degree. There were some particular stories, such as Medellin, which were heralded as the Medellin miracle, how to reform a violent city. Even today, Medellin is often presented as the model to be emulated in Mexico, for example. Then, as of 2008, things have sort of stalled, and heading into 2010, some of the trends are either not progressing or, in fact, are deteriorating, including in the security situation. I should also emphasize that beyond what's happening in the security situation, that there have been some robust institutional improvements. For example, if one looks at the judicial system in Colombia, arguably, that is one of Colombia's greatest stories, especially in terms of the capacity of the judicial system to put a check on the executive and develop levels of accountability. But even in the judicial system, there are some still serious deficiencies that need to be tackled. I think very positively, when President Santos was elected, he sort of understood that despite the security successes of the Uribe era, deep socioeconomic issues that have historically plagued Colombia and in many ways are at the root of lots of Colombia's security problems had to be addressed. There was very little attention paid to them during the era of President Uribe, and President Santos very clearly put this at the forefront of his agenda, reducing poverty, reducing social inequality, bringing the state to areas that historically have not had very meager or altogether non-existent state presence. the Santos administration embraced a population-centric counterinsurgency plan. It has its previous versions, sort of test runs during the latter parts of the Uribe. It's called the Consolidation Plan. On paper, it is designed as one would want to see a counterinsurgency plan designed with robust security present, meant to secure the population, prevent attacks on the population from a variety of actors, bring police in, and then bring in socioeconomic development, judicial system, rule of law. And one area, especially the Macarena region, was sort of the test case and the one that then was supposed to be emulated. But here is where the buts and the problematic details come in a number of these policies. So although Macarena was the test run, it was very soon it became obvious that Macarena was a relatively small region, and essentially no other place the Colombian government has the capacity to put in the level of resources that went to Macarena, including in terms of security presence, police and military presence. And so the government has really struggled with where else this plan can be implemented, what are the strategic zones, and it really had to scale down very significantly the amount of areas that would be subject to similar approach, even with fewer resources than Macarena. The second important problem arose that the demobilization of the paramilitaries didn't go so well. Yes, they demobilized, but as Kevin already prefaced, new armed groups have emerged. Some of them have just almost continuous linkages to the old paramilitaries with the same individuals, both in leadership and rank and file members. Others are new groups that are nonetheless responding to the long-standing drivers of resource extraction or resource usurpation, rent extraction, from not just coca that continues to grow in Colombia, although at a smaller level than at the peak, but also gold mining, emerald mining, coal mining. And so all problems about land, displacement of people from land have re-emerged. And in some ways, sort of new warps have emerged. So often country experiences a security benefit, peace is established, and so economic activity is enabled. And in some places, Colombia is almost experiencing a peace deficit, where peace is established, land that previously could not be reached and hence was of little value, was not contested. But now there is new contestation, new displacement, land for the plantations of African oil palms. And so businesses still continue to be deeply complicit and tolerant of paramilitary or bandas criminales. The government doesn't call them paramilitaries, but of the presence of new groups displacing people. And some of the groups have reached accommodation with the FARC in some areas. In other areas, they fight the FARC. Urban violence also very much of an issue. Adam will speak about that, but you know the Medellin miracle could be called the mirage of Medellin miracle these days. And with all the focus on the socioeconomic issues, the challenge that the government faces, and I suspect that both Ginny and Claudia will pick up on that, is how to implement many of the plans that look great on paper on the local level, where redistributing resources in a more equitable manner, whether it's land restitution or some of the other socioeconomic programs that the government is talking about, will generate new opposition from groups, entrenched groups that have access to armed actors that will face significant reduction in their economic power if these plans are implemented well and in their political influence as well. And so there will be huge opposition. And it is precisely at the level of local institutions that the state is extraordinarily weak, where there is the deepest corruption, deepest complicitness and alliance with illegal armed actors. And so resolving that for the state will be critical, and the best plans can die in implementation, and that's the major challenge, and perhaps will be compounded, as you will hear from Claudia, after this election. Let me just say one word, a little bit about COCA. Coca is reduced, but it's still growing in Colombia. It's still a source of both income to extremely poor people, marginalized people who have essentially no capacity to access any other resources and who are hence deeply resistant and alienated as a result of eradication. But it also is still a continuous source of conflict as it pulls groups over to control access to coca. It's far from something that is over. And unfortunately, the one policy where the Santos administration did not break sufficiently with the Uribe years is to insist on this approach called zero coca, where the government demands that all coca is eliminated in any area before the community can receive any assistance from the state, policy that is ineffective and deeply counterproductive. So, you know, you see a lot of Colombian officials going around the world and telling the world that they can teach the government of Afghanistan how to do counterinsurgency, the government of Mexico how to tackle organized crime and do counter-narcotics, the government of Philippines how to demobilize paramilitary groups, and you see some of the same messages echoed in Washington. And there is, in fact, much that can be learned from Colombia. Colombian officials have a great learning experience, and there are major improvements. But it would be bad for everyone in the world who is receiving these messages to ignore the complexity, the challenges, these issues that are still deficient. So before you buy the Colombia miracle, not just the Medellin miracle, caveat emptor, there are many issues here that need to be tackled.
Thank you, Vanda. Adam.
Well, thank you, Kevin and Vanda and all of you for coming. It's an honor and a real opportunity for me to be able to talk a bit about what I've been observing in Colombia as well. And the organizers did ask me to talk about urban violence and land restitution, which don't overlap a lot, so there might be a rough segue in the middle, but let's jump into this. As far as urban violence, I mean, I wanted to talk about Medellin also because it's I was there for a little while in August, and maybe I'm the worst example of the foreigner who just parachutes in and parachutes out and comes up with some impressions, but I came out sort of confused by a contradictory picture. Example, we were in the Comuna 5 neighborhood on the northern extremity of the city, about halfway up the hills. We were actually with a member of Congress, and we were meeting with some active gang members. and not active duty because it's not duty, but they insisted that we walk around the neighborhood with them. And we're walking accompanied by some blue-vested representatives of the Medellin city government who are tasked to trying to build peace between gang members. We're walking down in the neighborhood where all the streets are paved. There's a school that looks pretty well supplied right there in the neighborhood. Electricity, clean water is all there. The services are all there. But one of the gang members who, he said he'd just gotten out of jail, points about three blocks down and says, "You see where that white car is parked over there? I can't go past there because the rival gang will kill me on sight." It's such a bizarre juxtaposition of what's happening there. And it seemed to be sort of emblematic of where things stand in a lot of the slums or the comunas that surround the city. And I would echo what Vanda said about Medellin, because the last few years have been fascinating. A few years ago, 2006, 2007, Medellin had a significantly lower murder rate, homicide rate, than Washington. That is not true anymore. Things, as in much of Colombia's security situation, things are better than they were in 2002, but they're not better than they were in 2008. The homicide rate began to climb again very rapidly in Medellin after 2008, homicide and other crimes. After Don Berna, Diego Fernando Murillo, the paramilitary leader, demobilized but still mafia leader, who really ran criminality in Medellin, had a monopoly on it, was extradited to the United States in May of that year. He left behind a vacuum of criminality. Mid-level commanders who had been under him before began to fight each other all over the comunas. The homicide rate tripled, just about tripled, from 2007 to 2009. It started to go down a bit last year, but only a bit. The homicide rate is expected to be in the 75 to 80 range this year, which is about the same as Salvador or Honduras. Not as high as Chihuahua, Mexico, but still far higher and about double that of Washington. So what does that tell us about the Medellin miracle or mirage or whatever you want to call it? It does tell us that what critics were calling Don Bernabilidad, her a pun on governability, was real. That a lot of the advance happened because following the demobilization of the paramilitaries, there was a monopoly on control of criminality in the very strategic city of Medellin. And if there's a monopoly, that means it's not under dispute. If you live in non-disputed territory, violence tends to go down and prosperity goes up, and that can often appear to be just an effect of good governance. That is not to diminish the impact of good governance in Medellin. Medellin has had two pretty solid mayors in the last 8 years, Sergio Fajardo and Alonso Salazar, who, for the most part, were not corrupt, did not tolerate corruption, and launched a series of sort of livability and public space and civic culture programs all over the city, and spent resources relatively wisely. And a testament to that, despite the fact that the murder rate and other violence rates have gone up since 2008, they have not gone up anywhere near the levels that they were at the turn of the last decade, 2000, 2002, or during the heyday of Pablo Escobar. That's when homicide rates were approaching 200. And they're not going to, because there is more of a presence, particularly of the city, but also of the national government. I think now we're back at what was more the baseline or more believable level of violence with better governance efforts. And I think they do get some of the credit, some of it, not all of it, for the fact that violence rates have declined somewhat in the last year and a half or so. What the violence looks like, though, when it does take place in the comunas, it's very similar to what I think you see in many Latin American cities or what you even saw in Medellin in the past. When you get down to the ground in the neighborhoods, it's gangs. It's territorial gangs. It's young people, ages 14 to 25 for the most part. It involves a lot of vengeance killings, sicariato, and it involves a lot of what I was talking about before, the invisible barriers that exist between neighborhoods, the territoriality being strictly enforced. The competition is usually at this point over microtráfico, narcomenudeo, trying to sell the right to sell drugs on street corners. And what is different, though, perhaps, is whom the gangs are allied with or aligned with or controlled by. In Medellin, for example, it has gone, you know, from guerrilla militias 20 years ago or 15 years ago to paramilitaries controlling it to now really the two main overall leaders of Medellin are guys named Sebastian and Valenciano, both of whom have ties, one each, to the new neo-paramilitary emerging criminal groups, one with the Rastrojos, another with the Urabeños. Sebastian right now seems to have the upper hand in the battle for Medellin. This also may account for some of the drop in criminality in the last year and a half because there's less, fewer neighborhoods in dispute. One lesson from Medellin is that, yes, good governance is important, but the governors should be careful how much credit they take for drops in criminality. I think that's a lesson that's important for places like Ciudad Juarez or Nuevo Laredo also. Also, another final lesson there is that city services are good. Governance efforts at the local level are better than they've ever been. The police are still a wild card and a question mark, and they're not under the full control, particularly force levels, are not under the full control of the mayor's office, nor is the justice system, which remains absent or ineffective in much of the city. Countrywide, the general trends of urban violence are showing not as marked a turnaround as Medellin, but similar concerns. In Bogota, the homicide rate bottomed out at about 19.5 in 2006. Last year, it was up to 23.5. Not dramatic, but enough that it's really showing up in opinion polls and conversations in perceptions of insecurity in Bogota. In Cali, the homicide rate bottomed out at 67 in 2008. It was 81 last year. Major cities are still, again, better than 2002, but worse than just a few years ago. The government's plan for dealing with this is not entirely clear. It does, however, involve the addition of 20,000 more police. That would bring the national police force nationwide to about 180,000 members. The police force has already increased by about 25,000 in the last 4 years, while the armed forces, in fact, have shrunk by about 10,000 in the past 3 years. So more of an emphasis on police and less of an emphasis on armed forces is what we're seeing. That does respond to urban violence concerns. It also responds to changes in the tactics of the FARC, who are much more mixed in with the population, smaller units, more plainclothes operations, and the emergence of the criminal bands. Whether it is enough and whether the police and the justice system are up to that challenge is something I know I'm running short on time. I wanted to discuss community policing youth programs and deficiencies in the justice system. But for time's sake, maybe we can save that for the questions, and I'll move on to the question of land restitution, which is absolutely critical if we're going to talk about peace in Colombia. The land tenure situation lies at the heart of causes of the conflict. It lies at the heart of the huge historic wave of displacement that Colombia has suffered, particularly over the last 30 years. This is a country that never really had a land reform, unlike most of Latin America did in the 20th century, and then in the 30 years saw a massive reverse land reform. The UNDP just came out with a report about a month ago that found that 1.15% of Colombia's landholders control 52% of the country's agricultural land. 80% of small landholders in the country are below the poverty line. And as many, according to the UNDP, 6.6 million hectares, a hectare is 2.5 acres, you do the math, 6.6 million, about 13% of all agricultural land was taken, or people that were dispossessed from it and usually displaced from it by violence in the last 30 years or so. But expectations are being raised that this is going to be resolved at least partially. In June, President Santos signed into law a Victims and Land Restitution Bill, among whose goals is the return of about 2 million hectares. That would only be about a third of the total, but 2 million hectares of land. That process is, you know, in the slow process of getting started now. I mean, there are constitutional court reviews of the bill, of the law. Regulations for implementation are being drawn up. There's a lot of consultations with civil society about how these regulations are going to end up. They're setting up the agencies that are going to be carrying out land restitution. There'll be about 22 offices for it around the country. And there is sort of a pilot program, a plan choque, that's been going on in much of the country, although that has mostly just been handing out titles to lands that before had belonged to the government and did not have an owner before. This faces a lot of challenges if it's actually going to happen. If it was easy, they would have done it by now, but the challenges really are legion. The first is simply security. Where are you going to actually do this that the country is actually considered post-conflict enough to begin? Cordoba, Urabá, the Pacific coast, the consolidation program zones, where is it safe enough? Where is it green enough to actually move forward? That appears to be a point of much disagreement within the government, particularly between the agriculture ministry and the defense ministry. And if you don't attend to some of the most hard-hit zones, you've got a vicious cycle where, you know, you have areas where the despojo or the dispossession of land has made the conflict worse and lies at the root of the conflict, but because the conflict's so bad, you can't undo the despojo. And that requires some really tight coordination with the security forces that has not yet, we have not seen signs of it yet. Another big challenge is simply the legal hurdles, the testaferros, or third-party landholders who have to be identified and kicked off the land. The fraud, massive fraud, with the help of the state and power politicians over the past several years that, you know, falsifying land titles and falsifying transactions, and they've got to get behind all of that. The agriculture minister himself says that he found the state land agency, the INCODER, to be supremely infiltrated and that regional offices were practically co-opted by the paramilitaries when he came to power a year and change ago. And that means they go through all these files and find massive amounts of falsifications. The campesinos just didn't stand a chance as legal maneuverings deprived them of the land that they thought they owned. In Montes de Maria, which is going to be a crucial laboratory, this is a region in the north near the Caribbean coast, a crucial laboratory for land restitution, small but fertile region that saw 50 massacres just between 1999 and 2001. A third of some of the municipalities' populations kicked off their land in that 2 or 3 year period. Just there, so far, the agricultural ministry has found fraudulent purchases of 40,000 hectares of land, and there's probably going to be more. They're carrying out similar investigations in several other parts of the country. Other legal obstacles just include just the horribly difficult task of mapping out where exactly are the predios, the land holdings, in the first place. The fact that a lot of the land that people were kicked off was held informally. 40% of land holdings in Colombia are not formally titled. People who were forced to sell just by the debts they accumulated while they were displaced, had they not properly dotted every I and crossed every T in how they registered as displaced people. People who bought in good faith but found out that, are now finding out or have yet to find out that the land they bought was actually owned by somebody who was violently kicked off. And what do you do for them? There is a question, another question of could you have actually made a good faith purchase in the last 10 years in a place like Montes de Moria where massive displacement and massacres had happened anyway? I mean, the probability of having bought the land of somebody who was violently kicked off was quite high. The other challenge, and this is one that I think Claudia will be talking about quite a bit too, is the pushback that is inevitably going to be coming from the landowners in a lot of these areas. We may see some of the pushback in the results of the elections, the local, municipal, and gubernatorial elections that are happening on October 30th. It's very likely that many of the landowners who don't have any intention of giving up their land holdings to the victims have been backing candidates who are flush with cash and likely to win. But I'm sure Claudia Lopez will be discussing some of these questions about candidates. But you need local officials. You need these governors and mayors in particular to be on board if you're actually going to be doing a credible land restitution process. They have a crucial role to play. If they're dragging their feet, if they're throwing up legal obstacles, if they're if they're hiring people to be in charge of the or representing them at the relevant mesas or coordinating committees who are on the side of the original dispossessing landholders, this could get stalled very quickly. Meanwhile, there's the security situation of people who do get their land returned. We've already seen more than 50 representatives of displaced and victims and land rights communities killed since 2008, and roughly 20 since President Santos took over. I would say that it's more dangerous right now in Colombia to advocate for the return of land than it is to denounce a human rights abuse committed by the military. Both are dangerous, but the risk seems to be even higher in cases of land because people want to hang on to those assets and are willing to go to great lengths to do so. Protection of land activists and victims and people who are going to receive land is important, but ultimately you can't deploy the military and the police to protect everybody all over the country. People are going to be exposed. More important than even the physical bodyguard-type protection, then, is what happens after someone is killed. What happens? What is the probability that somebody who kills or orders the killing or the intimidation of somebody who's receiving land will actually be punished or not? Right now, that probability is close to zero, and that has to change. Of the 20 cases of land leaders since the beginning of the Santos government, I know of no case that has gone beyond the preliminary investigative phase in the justice system. The justice system, as with urban violence, lies really at the heart of this. And I'll tell you, the experience of, even after years of this acrimonious free trade debate, the experience of killings of labor leaders does not encourage me that the justice system is up to the job right now, has the resources, has the protection, or has the political will behind it. If the justice system isn't up to the job, the pushback against land restitution could be successful over the next several years. That would be disastrous for prospects for peace. If the dispossessors get to keep their land, it will prove the guerrillas right, and the guerrillas really don't have a lot of moral standing right now. The elections then, because of who will be brought to power to actually carry out land restitution in some of the most highly contested areas, are a key moment. We may be looking back on the October 30th elections when we try to determine what were some of the main factors in the success or failure of land restitution a few years from now. It's really a hinge or a fulcrum moment, and we should all be paying attention to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. That was terrific. Claudia, the elections.
Thank you so much. Well, it's really a great honor and a great opportunity to be before this great audience and to speak about Colombia's elections that are coming in a week or so to elect governors and mayors. It's a big challenge. And, of course, as any other topic in Colombia, the assessment of how it is going to be always depends on which year you choose as a baseline to compare with. So if we compare against 1997, for example, or the elections, the local election held in 2000, we are by far, in any indicator, doing better now. But if we compare to the last local election, 2007, there are some issues that we already lost. There are some advantages that we already lost. For example, violence in the pre-electoral period doubled during this election, which means we have doubled the number of candidates that were kidnapped, doubled the number of candidates that were killed, doubled the number of candidates that were threatened. So that picture is already a bad picture. So in the pre-electoral election level, we already did pretty bad compared to the last local election, 2007. The second thing that's going to happen here, so why this violence again? Well, part of the answer was already given here, right? This, to some extent, the recomposition of the different illegal groups in Colombia, starting from FARC and different tactics and trying to adapt to the new situation and to the success of the army in previous years. If you're confronted successfully in one way, you learn. Everybody learns. Everybody adapts. And that's what happened in particular with guerrilla groups. Now, as for paramilitary groups or new criminal groups, there is a huge fragmentation and competition after the 2008 year, in which, mainly because of this massive extradition process of the former paramilitary bosses, it, of course, exploited all this internal competition between different AUC groups and new groups, groups that never were involved in the demobilization and peace-dealing process with President Uribe, as, for example, Los Rastrojos. One of the things that amazed me is that Los Rastrojos is by far the largest cartel in Colombia today, and nobody talks about them. And that's certainly one of the reasons of their success. All the attention is put on somebody else's, and that's certainly quite a PR strategy for them. AUC, as we all know, AUC were the largest federation drug cartels in Colombia's history, the largest and the most successful. And if you analyze by today, with all the information, the judicial information and all that we have been able to get because of the peace and justice process and because of the very demobilization process, we know that any figure we can to compare, if a former ambassador remember the cartel of the Cali in your time or the cartel of Medellin, they look like babies compared to the AUC times. So we have this huge cartel federation, huge drug traffickers federation, that for some reason we decided to deal with as if they were political fighters, even though we all knew they were not, right? And we offered demobilization. And this is just as simple as drug traffickers don't demobilize, period. It's as simple as that. There is no rational reason why we should expect a drug trafficker to demobilize. A drug trafficker doesn't have a retirement plan. It's not that they are expecting, well, at some point I'm going to get off of this business, I'm going to buy a house in Florida, I'm going to retire. No, that's not the way it works, right? You know that you are then going to end up in impunity or in death or in jail. But certainly retirement is something that cannot happen in the drug business cartel. And even though we know that, and we all acknowledge that since at least 10 years ago, to put some year as a baseline, all illegal armed groups in Colombia are heavily involved in drug trafficking, and so their operation, their military and political operation, are driven by that main business. We're still trying to deal with them as if they were not that kind of group. So there is a huge fragmentation, there is a huge competition. And that's one of the reasons why this huge pre-electoral violence has increased. Because you may have some advantage if you get the mayor and the governor on your side in regular times. But if you are in a competing situation with another criminal group, and any of the groups is better able to get the governor or the mayor on their side, they got a huge advantage against the other groups. They will be able to have better security info, operations, information about likely operations against them. They probably, if one group takes the governor's office and is able to coordinate with the police and with the army operations against the other group, that really threatens the other group. So that's why I think that's one of the reasons that we are seeing all these tensions and this violence. It's basically because one of the armed groups is not willing to allow any other group to get the strategic advantage to get the governor or the mayor on their side. They know they're going to be punished and chased. There's a strategic advantage for them. They're not going to allow to do that. The second reason I think I'm extremely worried that although we all now have much more information and sort of signs to be sure about this, is that
the state in Colombia, the regional and the local state, not to say the national, of course, in many different institutions, is a huge opportunity for money laundering. The contracting services at the local and regional level, especially in regions where you are receiving royalties because of mining and all that stuff, is a huge opportunity for money laundering. And money laundering is the better, is the most profitable part of the productive chain of the illegal business. It's far better to do money laundering at some point in Medellin or in whatever, in any other region, than to do coca growing in the far away areas. So if you're able to get the governor's office or the mayor's office, you're going to be able to use the contracting apparatus of the state to do money laundering. And it's a huge business. Many of the things that we see in the finance movements to support different candidates is basically they're pre-buying the contracting apparatus of that governor's office or that mayor's office. So that's the third reason. You're not willing to lose such opportunity. It's very important and a strategic part for your business, in addition to have better information security or whatever it is. So that's coming from the sort of the legal arm side. Why are they fighting to keep these positions or to not lose the positions they already have or not to allow other groups to get that advantage? Now, let's see the picture on the political side. As you said at the very beginning, according to the official government figure, at least 10% of the candidates that are still running, have criminal records. The first question, of course, is why can't they run? There is something wrong in the institutional legal side. If we know that, and these candidates still can't run, and still can't win, right? But putting that first problem aside, as you all know, President Santos presented himself as a sort of good, loyal successor of President Uribe. There was no way Juan Manuel Santos could win the national election without the votes and the support and the electoral apparatus of President Uribe. However, after 1 year, I think it's quite clear for everybody that President Santos decided not to keep the entire agenda of President Uribe. That may please many people that thinks, for example, that the victims law or the land reform law is very important, is quite useful for Colombia's challenges. But, of course, that also irritates many people, in particular, many former Uribe's president supporters, right? So President Uribe was able, one of his strength points, I'm not going to mention all, but at least one in the political arena, that he was able to build this regional base to national level coalition composed of both legal and illegal forces, political and illegally armed group forces that are combined in the regional level that never before him had the chance to get up to the national level is in such a strong position. I mean, there is no, it's not just by chance that third of Congress members of President Uribe coalition are in jail because of ties with drug traffickers and paramilitary groups. This was one of the weakest points, but also one of the strongest points in the electoral base that President Uribe's coalition had. So if you said now, well, what is the coalition of President Santos? Well, the answer is the same. The same parties, the same leaders, the same political structures at the regional and national level are there. All the former parties that supported President Uribe are supporting President Santos. So if you said that story, you can conclude, so it's the same coalition. Now everybody remains in the same position of power as before. No. Formally, the names of the parties could be the same. I mean, La U is there, Cambio Radical is there, the Conservative Party is there. The only new party in the coalition is the Liberal Party, right? All of the rest are the same guys. So why is the change? If the same parties are there, if the same leaders are there, what changed? Well, what changed was the
I will say, sort of the terms of power relationship within the coalition. To put it in simple terms, the regional, more hybrid, more illegal, more linked to paramilitaries and drug traffickers were far stronger before within the coalition than now. They were left out of the main positions, as we already know. And in the first term of President Uribe, these guys were able to get quite good appointees. The DAS, the INCO there, couple of ministers, very important positions. They already lost those positions. So although they are part of the coalition, and nobody, not even them or the government, is willing to declare a rupture. We're not going to go together. We're not going to do business. Nobody's willing to take that chance. We're going to sort of remain in the pictures and say, yeah, here we are governing. But in reality, and from inside, the level of influence of these regional political groups changed heavily within the coalition. And now the more, let's put it, urban side of the coalition is much more in power, because that's where President Santos is coming from. He's coming from this sort of urban, national, traditional elite, and not coming from this sort of mixture, regional, cattle rancher, paramilitary base of the regional elite. So they are still together, but the terms of power within the coalition is completely changed. Completely changed. So what's the battlefield, the new battlefield? Of course, they are not pleased by this fact. You know, you can read the papers, and many of them there to say publicly, oh, we were better treated under President Uribe. What it means is this. We were the leaders of this coalition before. We are no longer, and we are resenting that. So the new battlefield for this inside fight is the local and regional elections, of course, because this part of the coalition needs, if they want to survive in power, needs to make clear before President Santos they are still there, and he still needs them. And he can't dismiss them forever. And the only chance they can make that point is by winning as much governor's offices and by as much mayor's offices as they can. So it's a huge tension because of this internal change within the coalition, right? And in order, it's again a cycle. In order to do that, you may do that just making the best campaign you want, or you can do that too, looking for the support of your old friends. So of course trying to win against a candidate that doesn't exist because you killed them is far easier than trying to run against a candidate that is still there. Right? So that's the third factor that is driven tension and explaining both the violent tension and the political tension we are facing now in this local election. So, of course, local elections, local electoral years are always more violent than the previous year. Always, unfortunately. Always. So this is not the first time. It was totally, it's absolutely expected. You can expect that the 2011 is going to be more far violent than 2010. As you could expect that 2007 was going to be more violent than 2006. That has been the history of Colombia. We don't have political violence because we have drug trafficking. We have had political violence throughout our entire history, unfortunately, right? So that was expected. But if you compare the trend of the national elections, we did much better in 2006, both in political and in violent terms, than in 2002. If we compare the last elections, 2010, we did far better than the two previous years. So now we are still under this pressure. Are we going to do better than in 2007? We know that already, that in pre-electoral terms, we didn't. Unfortunately, that's gone. So in 10 weeks or no, no, in 10 days or something like that, we're going to know how the political picture looks like, who actually wins, how many of President Santos supporters within this key side of the coalition won, or how many of the other part? I don't want to call them the Uribe part because they are not entirely Uribe part. There are many others, figures and interests there. Right? They happen to be well represented under President Uribe. It doesn't mean that President Uribe is his boss, but that he can give orders to these guys. Not any longer.
Right? He's not always in power. You could give that orders when you were in power. When you're not in power, you cannot give orders. You might be a good friend. You maybe inspire them. You, probably they like them better, but it's not the same position as before. Just to recap, this year's elections is incredibly tense because of this recomposition of the illegal groups, in particular the former paramilitary groups, because of the readaptation of the guerrilla groups, in particular FARC, that find a way to readapt their military strategies to defend themselves better and to be in a better position. It's also tense because of this recomposition within the political national coalition. And I will say, and I don't want to miss the opportunity to mention this last fact, it is in my opinion. I mean, 15 years ago, there was plenty of reason because why the army of the police in Colombia could say, we don't have enough resources, we are not large enough to regain control of this country, we need better equipment, we need better support in terms of intelligence and other sources. There is no reason whatsoever why the army or the police at this point of history cannot do that. And one of the challenges that President Santos, I guess, he's facing, of course, he's not never going to recognize that, is that to some extent, the army in particular has been in a kind of a strike in the last year. And that's, of course, a huge challenge. Huh? Basically, the deal is, well, if you push for all these peace and justice things, and people start telling the truth, and they start saying that they have ties with us, and that we support them somehow, some drug traffickers or some paramilitaries, now the justice is coming before us. They're chasing for us. They dare to prosecute some high-ranked military members. And we no are willing to accept that. Either we got clean and plain impunity from this picture, or we're not continue doing the job we're supposed to do. And that's a huge challenge. Nobody's willing to recognize this, of course. If you ask the army, of course, they will say that they are absolutely loyal and submitted to the civilian power in Colombia. But the reality behind the problems that we are facing, some of the problems that we are facing in security, is that it's this kind of brazos caídos kind of a strike strategy in the army in particular. So this is a key point. If President Santos, non-president, can ensure that he will be able to control and to give orders to the political spectrum, this is a democracy. Right? Politicians belong to different parties, to different ideologies. They are not supposed to receive orders from the president. But the army are supposed to receive orders from the president. So if the president cannot control neither the political arena nor the military, really we are in trouble. Really we are in trouble. So the key point is not only to regain the democratic security that we hope to have, but also to continue doing some sort of a strategic regional and national state-building process in Colombia. We need to be able to regain control both in the military and in the political arena. And that's part of what is at stake in this election. Thank you.
Thank you, Claudia. Virginia.
So it's left to me to talk about what the prospects are for the future, and I'm going to try to pick up on some of the ideas that have been presented so far. I think we could look at the different issues from both the international, national, and regional level. And again, it does depend what baseline you're looking at, but I'm going to start with Santos coming into power and how some of the environment has changed within Colombia that makes, in some ways, the prospects for peace more hopeful, in other ways, less hopeful. And on the first front, I think if we think back to when Santos came in, war was practically breaking out on the borders with Venezuela and Ecuador. And I think that on the international level, if we think about Colombia within the region, we see that the tensions have been tamped down quite considerably. Santos has really made an effort to become a global leader and as well as a regional leader for Latin America. He secured Colombia a place on the UN Security Council, and I think that's been very important for Colombia's international prestige. Colombia now heads up UNASUR through Maria Emma Mejia. That's another very important position within the hemisphere. There have been both trade and political relationships opened up to many different parts of the world. So there's a less of a dependency, I think, on the U.S. and the U.S. vision. Also, there's been a free trade agreement approved with the United States, and that was a huge feather in the cap of Santos, I believe, even though this is something that's been coming for many, many years. However, I think it's also very ironic in some ways. Santos came in and he acknowledged, as his predecessor did not do, that there was an internal armed conflict in Colombia. The irony is that, in fact, it's no longer an internal armed conflict. If you look at the figures, the conflict really is spilling over the borders of the region. UNHCR just came out with statistics, 200,000 refugees are in Venezuela, 95% of whom are Colombians who have fled the conflict. There's some 130,000 in Ecuador, Colombians in Ecuador. There, in 2009, there were 389,000 refugees in 36 countries of the world. So the refugee situation is quite high, and the internal displacement continues to be extremely high, with 3.7 million displaced internally. Colombia is now the country with the largest displaced population in the world, and that's beating out Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, other places of war zones. So I think, you know, on the international level, we see political dialogue and communication among governments in a much better capacity than it was a year and a half ago. But we also see the prospects for new tensions with increasing numbers of refugees that need to be processed, need to be dealt with in some way, some humane way. And I think a movement within civil society and the international community to find ways to regularize the treatment of refugees and to accord them the kinds of protections of states that citizens would ordinarily be granted. On the other hand, inside of Colombia, you also see an escalation of war. And this is, you know, Colombia has always fascinated me in part because it's like a Gabriel Garcia Marquez magical realism. Depending on who you talk to, you can be talking about the same country and have completely different visions of what's happening. On my last trip, I was in Bogota, and the euphoria about the victims' law, the land restitution, all the changes, the kinds of acknowledged apologies for what happened to Juan Manuel Cepeda, the UP leader who was assassinated, an apology from the state for what happened. There were all sorts of indications that things had changed dramatically with the coming of Santos. And then you leave Bogota and you go to the regions, and in Cordoba, in Montes de Maria, in the North Atlantic coast, in Antioquia, in Magdalena, in different parts of Colombia, you find that, in fact, the war has gotten worse. Mm. The violence has escalated. The fear factor has increased. You start looking at the violence in this pre-electoral period, and it's horrendous. You look at questions of impunity and accountability, and Colombia is not doing any better than it was before. In fact, it may be doing worse because the violence is going up and the prosecutions have not kept pace. You have a Congress that's one-third indicted, that was one-third indicted, and Claudia Lopez and her colleagues at the Fundación Nuevo Arcoíris did incredible work documenting the penetration of the paramilitary within the legal structures and the elected government structures, particularly at the regional and local levels. And we also see, you know, the whole justice and peace law that was approved back in 2005 that really hasn't, you know, it's led to 4 convictions in 6 years, which is not a lot. But what it has done is revealed tremendous levels of corruption and of complicity between the government and the paramilitaries. We know that one-third of the Congress was convicted, but I also just saw some recent statistics that, you know, when the paramilitaries gave their confessions, the versiones libres, a lot of information was revealed that could be followed up by the judicial system, but has not been. And, in fact, the Supreme Court turned over evidence to other prosecutors to investigate 24 governors, 225 mayors, 11 local representatives, and 55 council people. And none of these have been followed through on. So you can see that we're at the national level, I think, and in Bogota, people are much more optimistic that things are changing, that there's a possibility of peace to come, that there are, in fact, I think that when Santos came in, there's been a very interesting flurry of exchanges with the different guerrilla leaders from both the ELN and the FARC, with the leadership claiming that they're interested in dialogue. Alfonso Cano released a video right before the new president came into power and said, you know, hablemos, you know, we want to talk. We have, and he laid out actually an agenda of the things he wanted to talk about, and they were political reform, land reform, human rights and international humanitarian law, economic reform. And actually each of the topics that the FARC, that Alfonso Cano said he was interested in talking about, President Santos has taken on and is looking at ways to deal with each of those, not through a direct dialogue of sitting down at the table with the guerrillas necessarily, but I think really trying to pull the rug out from under the guerrillas in terms of what their agenda might be, so that down the road we may get to a point, if the land reform and restitution is successful, we may get to a point where sitting at the table, many of the issues that the guerrillas might have brought to a peace table have already been taken care of. And that's in the best of cases. I think there are the challenges to moving forward with the land restitution and the victims' laws are tremendous, and Adam has hinted at some of them. But I think also if we think about just the pool of potential victims and victims in Colombia, and trying to figure out administratively, legally, technically, humanly, psychologically, there is so many different ways that dealing with such a large pool of millions of victims is going to be very, very difficult, that I think there's the prospects ahead are not terribly optimistic. I know we're just about, how are we? Yeah. We're okay on
3 minutes.
Time. Yeah, we're okay on time. And I think we want to leave room for discussion as well. But I think that in some ways the prospects for peace are looking glum, but the prospects for dialogue are actually looking better than they've looked in a long, long time. And it may very well be that in the not-so-distant future, we do see a peace table put together that's probably between the guerrillas and the government. I think one of the biggest changes we're seeing under Santos is that people are talking about peace. They're discussing what the mechanisms might be. They're discussing what the nature of the discussions might be. They're discussing what the agenda might be. The Senate, Senator Roy Barreras presented a law for peace, and this has generated all sorts of discussions. I don't think it's resolved anything, but it's passed kind of a first stage in the Congress. It has eight more stages to go through. But part of this law would actually look at the question of who gets reduced sentencing. And for the first time, I think ever in Colombia's history, there is a law that's looking at reduced sentences for military who commit human rights violations in the course of duty, let's say. Now, this is tremendously controversial. I mean, there are many who would say that the International Criminal Court has already dispensed with the idea that a government can give itself its own amnesty, and there's a consideration that, in fact, this would be the state giving the state or forces of the state an amnesty. And so even if it were to go through legally within Colombia, that there's a very good chance it would call on the wrath of the ICC to come in and say, you know, you guys can't do this, just like Pinochet or the Argentines couldn't give their own military an amnesty. So I think it has a lot of hurdles still to go through, and it's likely to go through a lot of different revisions. Colombia has a very strong constitutional court that has been a real, I think, protector of international norms. It's challenged when the Colombian legislature passes laws that are somehow found not to meet the standard of international human rights and humanitarian law. The constitutional court has often modified them or overturned them, and as it did with the Law of Justice and Peace back in 2005, and I think it's likely to do the same. I would just mention also that, you know, what happens in the regions, and for this reason, what happens in the elections is really important. The elections really may mark a turning point in the future of the direction, the path to peace in Colombia. And I think it's really, I think it behooves us all to keep our eyes on what's happening. There was an article that came out in Semana also that mentioned many of the places where there are, and Claudia has referred to it, but I think until you see the specifics, you don't get a sense of the magnitude of the number of power politicians who are running, the number of FARC candidates who are running, people supported by one or the other illegal armed group. And to the extent that the system, the electoral system, legitimizes the role of these illegal armed actors, including bandas criminales, in the system, the possibilities for some sort of a meaningful transition to peace will be minimalized. They will be reduced significantly. So I would end with that and open for questions, or turn back to you for questions.
Thank you, Jeannie. Well, that was phenomenal. Just before we go into the Q&A, for those of you who are in the back, there are seats in the front, and you're more than welcome to come join us in the front. I have a couple of issues that I want to raise. If you allow me, the first one is about Medellin. I find the whole discussion fascinating because it suggests a very profound point, which is relevant well beyond Medellin, which is that the absence of violence doesn't mean better rule of law. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, when you have a desperate population, desperate because violence has spun out of control, you know, the Pax Mafiosa is a bargain that a lot of people are willing to make. You know, and I would imagine that if you go and ask people in Monterrey these days, you would find a lot of people willing to strike that bargain. So my question is, whether we know what the people in Medellin are thinking. Because we may find that what the people are thinking in terms of, you know, going after after the mafiosos and improving the rule of law is very different from what the government is trying to do. You know, the attitudes towards the Pax Mafiosa amongst the population in Medellin is something that strikes me as very interesting and that has implications for places beyond Medellin. That's number one. And number two, I'm slightly surprised about the fact that other than a few times in Jeannie's presentation, the FARC was barely mentioned, as though they were a relatively marginal actor in this whole story. So my question would simply be, I mean, what are they up to? And particularly when it comes to the issue of land restitution, because as Jeannie alluded to tangentially, one would think that the success of the land restitution policy poses a very, you know, a strategic challenge to the FARC. And amongst the people, I would think that would have an interest, that would have an incentive to push back against land restitution, paradoxically, would be the FARC. So what do we know about that? I'll leave it there, and then we turn it over to the audience.
Do you want to answer now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, maybe I'll start, and we can join, you know, on Medellin. The story of the Pax Mafiosa or narco piece is, I think, complex. And one of the things, important things that Adam was just saying was the opening narrative of what the situation looks like with the gang members saying, I cannot go beyond the car. One of the things that has emerged in Medellin is even as the boundaries between Sebastian and Valenciano groups are stabilizing, people are finding it extremely difficult to cross the boundary. So kids are told they cannot go to an elementary school that is two blocks away, but lies in the territory of Sebastian as opposed to Valenciano. People cannot go to work. There is a lot of pressure to either physically eliminate or expel from the areas FARC that have demobilized, that have gone through the official demobilization problems. So it's a level of peace that is still contested and that is very problematic for people. It's very different than the Don Berna peace, where he really controlled the city and the rules were clearer and there were sort of greater, I'm reluctant to say greater freedoms because I think there's some sort of contradiction or oxymoron in terms, but it's an even more problematic narco peace than it was under Don Berna right now. But violence is very much of an issue. On your second question on the FARC, Adam was also speaking about how the FARC has adapted. There is lots of violence by FARC, lots of urban violence, lots of terrorist attacks, lots of bombing of pipelines, lots of kidnappings. There is a lot of FARC activity both in the rural spaces and in the urban spaces that is very severely impinging on security. And in many areas, such as in Nariño, one of the very violent areas, there are real limits to how far the military forces can go. It's a very different proposition for them to be fighting big FARC columns or pinning them down somewhere in Macarena than taking the fight to Pasto. So that's very much of an issue. And the FARC has sort of difficult balance because if the FARC obviously subverts the land restitution, then it can be very clearly deprived of any vestiges of political support among especially people other than the Cocaleros. But at the same time, the FARC is benefiting from the pirates subverting it. And all the FARC can do is just sort of pull back and allow the pirates or the bandas criminales to subvert it
for
their own purposes.
Mm. You said an interesting point that the absence of violence doesn't mean better rule of law. And, you know, that almost reminds me of the United States, where illegal drug consumption, when you throw in cocaine, meth, marijuana, et cetera, is down somewhat from 20 years ago. But drug-related violent crime is a fraction of what it was a year ago, or 20 years ago. And you look at opinion polls here, and drugs are like, you know, less than 0.5% of people nowadays think that drugs is the most significant problem facing the country. It has disappeared from our radar because of the absence of violence, even if it's still a pervasive problem in our society. And In Medellin, what are people in Medellin thinking? I could not tell you. I would not dare to speak for people who live there in these neighborhoods. You grew up in the stateless, you know, barrios around the edges of the city. One thing that I've heard many times is that people don't necessarily feel like they're at the mercy of or imprisoned by the gangs. That in an area where you could never trust the police, you could never trust the state, that territorial gang, these kids out there on the streets, were your protection from being extorted by others and being at the mercy of others. And they're, on some level, it varies, but almost pulling for their kids out there on the streets, protecting the neighborhood. That's the level to which things have gone. Paramilitaries all over the country curried favor with merchants and residents, but when they first arrived in a zone by carrying on social cleansing, killing prostitutes, drug addicts, beggars, and that made them more popular.
Of course.
So in an area where you don't ever think of, you know, the state or the justice system even being an option, the absence of rule of law is just not an issue. You just want absence of violence, and that's it. However, Mayor Alonso Salazar presided over this increase in crime in part because he did try to go after all groups rather than make pacts with any of them. That did not make him less popular. I mean, his approval rating even now is in the high 60s. Mm-hmm. So people do recognize the need to have rule of law. It just seems to be too far of an aspiration. Mm-hmm. As far as the FARC, I mean, Vanda covered it. The FARC really are in more marginal areas now. However, if you live in Cauca, Nariño, they are part of your everyday reality. But the populated areas, their actions are down. Less populated areas and areas of military police patrols in those areas, attacks do seem to be way up. The only point on land restitution I would add there, and others may dispute this, but the FARC's power centers tend to be more agricultural frontier zones, where land holding is more you cut down some jungle and that's your land until someone challenges you on it, and you're pretty much there, more sparsely populated. The areas where paramilitaries were strong overlay much more closely with the zones of reverse land reform. And so it's areas of paramilitary control where restitution is going to be probably more of an immediate issue.
Mm-hmm. That makes all the sense.
Do you want to comment on that? Or
I would just add, you know, the figure that I had seen is that military actions by the FARC are up 10% in the last year. Mm-hmm. And recruitment is up. The kinds of, they've readjusted, as Claudia alluded to, they've readjusted tactics to accommodate the government's increased presence and resources. So they're doing more land mining than they were before. They have much more small kind of ambush actions. They do not seem to have been diminishing their activity, although I think that everybody would agree that they have been beaten down and the numbers of the ones who were FARC members seem to have gone down significantly through demobilizations as well as attrition.
Yeah, but that all is at the sort of the tactical level. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, FARC are defeated at the strategic and political level in Colombia irreversibly, in my opinion. Right? That's clearly one of the most, probably the best achievement of Colombia society and governments in the last 15 years is that. And that's still there. Now, on the tactical level, we are having trouble, of course, because of this readaptation, and because last year were national elections, so it's always this story of the FARC. We're going to make sure the new government understands we are still here. Yeah, they're still there, and they are making that point clear. And also in the regional level, is the same story, right? So, yeah, they are provoking, I mean, a lot of trouble. But I will say, again, as my last point, what worries me is not why the FARC has increased 10% their attacks and their activity in the last year. I mean, that's worrisome, but I could see why that happened. What I don't understand and I can't accept is why the army has decreased by 4% their attacks by their initiative against the guerrillas. That doesn't make sense. That's not what you're sort of expecting. Mm. Right? So the problem is not they are pretty much active. The problem is our guys are inactive. That's the issue. And that's, we cannot control what the FARC does, but we should control what our army does. So that's what I would say. And on the prospects of whatever, peace, it's not that FARC is marginal, and it is marginal in the panel because it is marginal in the country. And it is marginal for election, and it is marginal for the prospects of Colombia. And that's going to continue being the road. Now, we cannot be overconfident, of course, and we need to be, you know, serious about dealing with the FARC still for many years along. But in regarding to land reform, I think, and I hope the government has this clear, and I'm pretty, you know, confident they are. If there is any prospect of success for the land reform, there are at least two things or three things we need to ensure. One is that this is not going to be a FARC cause. That's not their cause. That's our government cause. That's our government priority. That's a step in the political agenda that Colombia society and government has decided to take it, finally. Later, very, very, very later in our history, but at least we decided to take it. We cannot allow the FARC to take over this reform or any other significant political reform in Colombia. Basically because they don't have the representation to do that. We need to ensure, of course, that the Bakrin are not able to take over to resist the land reform, which is what they are doing now. And we need to ensure that both our military and civilian institutions are able to come aside with the government to implement the policy instead of supporting the land grabbers and maintain the alliance with them. We need to break that sort of tie.
Over to you, audience. We have, unfortunately, 10 minutes. Perhaps we can take four questions, and I would urge you to identify yourselves when you start posing your question. Over here.
Thank you. I'm Saul Esten from Phelps Stokes, formerly Institute of International Education. I want to say thank you all. I thought it was very thorough, especially you, Kevin, for the presentation of statistics. I really enjoyed it. As a person who completed my Fulbright research in Colombia and as a multi-ethnic scholar, I wanted to offer one other perspective, which wasn't really considered in this talk. And that is, one of the greatest challenges to Colombia's sustainable development is deep structural racism and a neglect for socioeconomic equity. We're talking about a country where the government has systematically underreported the number of Afro descendants and indigenous people present in the population for years, if not decades. We're talking about a country where most of the Afro descendants and indigenous people live geographically isolated in areas that have weak infrastructure and even worse schools. We're talking about a place where many of the victims, the majority of the victims of the land disputes and the attempts at land restitution have been Afro descendants and indigenous people. Recently, we have seen some progress because this late summer there was a law passed outlawing racial discrimination in public spaces. But still, there are a lot of lingering questions about enforcement with laws like that and new advances. So in a country like this, I want to ask, why are we not seeing more discussions about how to improve socioeconomic equity and racial equality enter into these sorts of discussions and into just the policy calculus when we consider Colombia's path toward sustainable development? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Rachel Schwartz. I'm from the Inter-American Dialogue. And my question is has been kind of alluded to in some brief comparisons to Mexico. But I've heard on multiple occasions, and especially among U.S. policymakers, this idea that the Colombian case should be held up as the blueprint for how to tackle criminality in places like Central America and Mexico, which are being ravaged by organized crime and drug trafficking. And so my question for you all as experts on Colombia is, how do you respond to this assertion? And are there any lessons, taking into account, of course, that all of these cases are distinct in so many different ways, are there any lessons from Colombia that we can learn in thinking about Central America and Mexico?
Thank you. In the back.
My name is Aaron Thompson. I'm with the Department of State. My question is specifically for Claudia Lopez regarding, I thought your observations on the internal dynamics of the governing coalition was fascinating, and I was wondering, as an outside observer of Colombia on a national level, how we'd be able to tell which side of the coalition was gaining the advantage in these municipal elections, if there's a specific party that'd be having the advantage. I know last year, you know, there were certain parties like the PIN that were associated with paramilitaries, but I don't know if that's still the case. So if you just have any observations on that, that'd be really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Last one. Okay, that was that. So I guess a couple minutes per speaker. Fanda?
I'll pick up on the Mexico comparison, and you know, I brought it up in my presentation. There are lessons from Colombia. There are forced lessons from Colombia. To neglect the problems and deficiencies would be critically incorrect. To some extent, Mexico itself bought onto this notion that high-value decapitation is what will reduce the power of the groups. This was based on the Medellin model. What was ignored in that narrative or in that lesson was the fact that when you had the Caldean Medellin cartel in the 80s, 1990s, it was a great bipolar system. You had two cartels. So when the government started focusing on the Medellin cartel, the Cali cartel was very happy to participate. And they destroyed the Medellin cartel, and voila, there was, you know, a period of immediate depression of violence because the Cali cartel took over. Now, it didn't last for a variety of reasons, including U.S. oversight and realizations how much the Cali cartel was complicit. But the other lesson that was not at all mentioned was the fact that you had great ability by the FARC and the Paras to plug into the drug trade, a massive escalation of civil war. Very different situation than in Mexico, where at the beginning you had about six drug trafficking organizations, high-value decapitation, broke them up, but also just eliminated the balance of power on the criminal market and precipitated the very intense, very uncontrolled right now criminal violence. You have lessons about the mobilizations of actors in both urban and rural spaces and the extraordinary difficulty of pulling it off critically. I think on the positive side, there are lessons to be learned about how to structure units within vetted, isolated units that are necessary to prevent the corrupt government officials from trying to subvert, especially high-value investigation. think there's much that Mexico can learn from that, as well as about how to reform police. But again, very incomplete story. Doing local intelligence in urban spaces for suppressing violence at the local level is very different than doing intelligence for high-value targeting. Both countries have massive problems. Colombia itself didn't overcome it. So, yes, there are important lessons, but the context matters a lot, and simply saying, oh, Medellin worked, and ignoring what didn't work in Medellin would be disastrous for Mexico. Same goes for intelligence reform, police reform, demobilization, structuring operations.
Yeah, I mean, Mexico probably doesn't have that much it can learn from from Colombia. The things that Vanda mentioned are largely tactical issues, how to improve intelligence, how to improve the way units work, and there are some things that could be taught there. I think there's often when there's discussion of Mexico or Colombia in the context of Mexico, there's a bit of nostalgia for perhaps for a moment when the recipient country's elite coalesced around a single plan and actually spent some of its own resources on that plan and showed some political will to actually move forward. And I don't want to diss the Mexicans too much, but there's, you know, it seems to be a lot more discussion about the 2012 elections and rearranging political deck chairs than, that really taking on this problem squarely, particularly problems like justice and reform of public security. But, you know, you can learn a lot from what was not done in Colombia, too, especially, again, justice. Creating employment, creating opportunities for youth, and actually exerting state presence, civilian state presence, in the countryside and other areas where there just wasn't one. And there's a lot that Colombia can show Mexico about what still remains to be done. And there's a whole host of other issues in Mexico, especially our own contribution in demand, arms, money laundering that just simply don't come out of the Colombia experience at all.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. And the question in the back, which I found very, very interesting.
Well, sort of the bad news is on November 1st, I can assure you everybody's going to declare victory, every side, right? So we're going to be quite confused by that. So President Uribe is going to say, we win, we won. President Santos is going to say, we won. The Liberal Party is going to say, we won. The leftist parties are going to say, we won. And to some extent, yes, everybody is going to win a little bit. Because there are no, I mean, party lines help for nothing. So forget about it. Party lines helps nothing in Colombia, unfortunately. This story, for example, that the PIN is the party related with the mafia, as if everybody else is clean, that's bullshit, of course. So we cannot take this story and make policy decisions based on it. At the same time, in the very same year, in the 2010, Ping was like the evil, right? Here is the party that's related. Wait, that same year, more members of the U party, La U party, were related and indicted because of ties with paramilitaries and drug traffickers than any member of the Ping party. Okay? The very same year in which PIN already doesn't exist because drug traffickers and politicians allied with them, they learned the lesson. Ah, so the PIN is discredited. So get rid of them. So they already built like three different parties. Now they are supporting their candidates through Afrovides, through MIO, through many other parties and many other coalitions. So who are the candidates now? Like 70%. All the candidates running right now for the most important offices in governors and mayor's offices are running based on coalitions. So no individual party can declare victory alone. Now, having said that, we have good enough information. When I said we, I refer by the government, the media, the NGOs who work on these issues. We have good enough information to have a clear picture of who's winning after a couple of days, after the election, right? So we know who's supporting each candidate in the most important cities and municipalities and governor's office. We know exactly that, right? So we can make an assessment of beyond the headlines and the pictures of the headlines of November 1st that are going to be not useful at all. So basically, let me tell you this story. If Enrique Peñalosa in Bogotá and Álvaro Vázquez in Antioquia don't win the election, everybody's going to declare President Uribe a defeat, mm-hmm. period, because they are the most noticeable candidates he is supporting. Now, if these two, of course, very important candidates, don't win the election, that it means that President Uribe actually lose or is defeated? No. Of course, a huge defeat for him. But it doesn't mean that at the regional level and in the whole political spectrum, he's losing. So we have to be careful. Right? But we have, it's complex, it's not easy. But yes, I would say we can have a clear picture. We have good enough information, both in the government agencies and in the non-government agencies, to have a clear picture of who won and who doesn't, who didn't, in the election after a couple of weeks.
Anyway, have Secretary Clinton call Claudia a couple of days after the election.
There you go. I'd like to address two of the questions, the question on discrimination and why the absence of discussion about ethnic minorities and also about women. Women have not been mentioned by any of us up at the front. And then the second question, lessons from Colombia. I have a couple of comments I want to make. On the question of marginalization, I think partly the reason is that they're not at the tables in Bogota at the highest levels. We are seeing there was a national encounter of Afro-Indigenous and peasants for land and peace in Barranca Bermeja in August of this year that was very significant. It brought 20,000 people from these different sectors around for several days to discuss what plans forward they might come up with for peace. And it was remarkable because it's the first time there's been a national gathering of that sort in many, many, many years. I'm assuming during the Caguan days there was more mobilization. But I think that kind of national mobilization of those sectors has not happened in a while. So I think that is noteworthy. But I think the other thing is, you know, in some ways, because these groups, women and ethnic minorities, have been the ones to be displaced, to be refugees, to suffer the real war in the regions, it's no surprise then that people in Bogota are really able to deny that the war continues on, because these are groups that are not sitting at the tables with them, telling them that the war goes on and we're feeling it. And the women especially, USIP is supporting a book that's coming out on the gendered dimensions of violence on the North Atlantic coast. It will give you chills up your spine. It is just the levels of violence against women and violence against transgendered, bisexual, homosexuals, as well as part of a kind of philosophical, ideological plan to gain control in sectors is just mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. So I don't know I hope that addresses a little bit of the question. I wanted to just turn briefly to the lessons from Colombia for Mexico, and I think it's really important not to take lessons wholeheartedly from Colombia for Mexico, because there's so many differences, and there's not time to go into those now. But what I would say is, you know, we've seen, and I was following the drug trafficking issues back when the U.S. Army invaded Bolivia back in 1986, and the debates have not changed that much. But one thing that I think people keep forgetting is this balloon effect, whether it's, you know, you crunch down on the drug trade in Bolivia and it reemerges in Peru, or it reemerges in Colombia, or you crunch down on the Putumayo and it comes out in Caquetá, or you crunch down on the cartels in Cali and Medellin and it goes to Las Zetas and the groups in Mexico. I think that we're trying to deal with the drug trafficking at a national level. We're using national policies instead of transnational alliances to deal with it. And they're not effective because of this balloon effect. We can anticipate that will happen. And until we have some sort of structures that we create that go beyond the nation state and the electoral period, I mean, I spoke to one Mexican official at one point, and he said, well, we just want to make sure the numbers go down while we're in power, while we're in office. And I think that's the kind of mentality that many bureaucrats who are responsible for implementing these policies have. They want to make sure that they can show success in their municipality, in their department, in their nation. And until you get beyond that to look more long-term and more globally, I think we're not going to find the solutions.
Well, thank you very much. We will be certainly watching the election results. And I only hope that now that the FTA has been ratified and that there's this kind of feel-good, you know, attitude that the good guys are running the show in Colombia, you know, we keep paying attention to what's happening. We will certainly be paying attention, and we certainly hope that you join us in future discussions about Colombia. Please thank our speakers.